07-7014, DNR Limited Partnership, Edgewood, United States of America, Appellant versus Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency. Mr. Cole, the appellant, Mr. Bondi, for the industry, I consider to be a good applicant.
May it please the court, my name is Carl Cohan, Jr. I represent the appellant, KNR Limited Partnership. I should like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This false claims action involves over $30 million, which the Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency has collected from HUD in complete disregard of the language, the notes which it drafted, and which it mandated be used by the borrowers. Under these notes, MHFA was required to reduce the interest rate it charged on the mortgage loans.
By the way, does HUD have to approve these notes?
Pardon?
Does HUD have to approve these notes?
Yes, I believe it did approve it. I don't know whether it has to, Your Honor, but I believe it did approve these note forms, at least in the early part of the 1970s when this program was getting started.
Mm-hmm. Is that in the record? Do we know that?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
But you're pretty sure they do approve them?
I do. Your Honor, I have read over 40,000 pages of material in this case. And I was a HUD official at one time in this program almost 40 years ago. And it's my recollection that these were originally reviewed by HUD. But I don't think necessarily they were continued to be reviewed by HUD. But the parties did enter into an interest reduction contract. And that spelled out many of the requirements that are applicable to the program over the years after the beginning thereof. If this rate of interest on these loans had been reduced as required by their language, it would have been a substantial interest reduction, rate reduction, that HUD would have had to subsidize. As we've made clear in the case, and HUD subsidizes the difference between the face amount of the mortgage note and the debt service thereon, and the debt service at 1% of the on that principal amount. And in some of these cases, that can be a lot of money, because some of them had mortgage interest rates at 7%, 8%, and 9%, and the difference between that and 1%, when you're talking about mortgage loans of 3, 4, 5, and sometimes $10 million is a lot of money. In February 1993, MHFA refunded over $600 million in bonds it had issued during the preceding 21 years, at interest rates running from 5.6% to 14.4%. These new bonds carried a net interest cost of 6.132%.
Would it have made commercial sense for MHFA to have done this if your interpretation were correct?
The bonds that were refunded, Your Honor, covered a broad range of programs and mortgages. Only 60% of them were 236 mortgages. MHFA is not a commercial entity.
But would it have made sense at all? Why go through it? I mean, it's not a commercial entity, but the money it's going to save here is going to free up more money for affordable housing in Massachusetts, correct?
Well, then you could rob a bank and free up and get money for housing, too. I mean, I'm not saying that that's what's happened here, but the end doesn't justify the means. It does not justify the means, I don't believe. And that's what MHFA is arguing here, that it is a good person, a good entity, and is using the money for good purposes. It also has a lot of employees who want to protect their jobs and keep themselves in business. So they have an interest in sustaining it themselves. And as is made clear by the information supplied, MHFA at this time was in significant financial difficulties.
Do you, I know your position is that we shouldn't even consider the Type 3 notes at all, right? Because they're post 93.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But do you agree that those notes do do lock in the interest rate?
They attempt to, yes.
Why would HUD have approved that?
The notes, I don't believe, each time a note was entered into, I do not believe that it was submitted to HUD for approval. This matter was not brought to HUD's attention until 1999.
Uh-huh.
And this bond refunding took place in 1993. Practically none of the owners of these projects were aware that the bonds had been refunded because MHFA made no effort to inform them of that. And there were owners of projects.
Well, the bond issuance wasn't hidden or anything like that.
No, but if you are an owner of an apartment project, it's highly unlikely that you'll know that someone's floating bonds unless someone calls it specifically to your attention.
Why did HUD keep paying this?
Pardon?
Why did HUD keep paying this?
I don't know. I can speculate.
HUD has an inspector general, right? The inspector general didn't. The auditors, nobody noticed this for all these years.
Well,
if it's so obvious, how do you explain that?
At the time that this matter was brought to the attention by our filing this suit in May of 1999, HUD was in the process of negotiating two substantial contracts with Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency. One for MHFA to take over the administration of its Section 8 program for HUD for the state of Massachusetts, and it still has that contract with HUD. Second contract was...
Wait, what's that got to do with my question?
Well, you asked me why HUD kept doing this. I suspect HUD was embarrassed by the fact that it would be joining in a suit claiming that an entity with whom it was contracting was defrauding it. And that's the... But there are... And I think the government will speak to that. It's not really... The issue is not why HUD did it, because the issue is whether this was a false claim. And is there sufficient basis, as we believe there is, to hold that there was scienter present, or at least to take the matter to trial in order to present to a trier of fact the information concerning scienter?
Speaking of scienter, if we assume for a moment we agreed with you that these notes were unambiguous in your favor, I take it you're not arguing that that resolves the scienter issue, right?
In other words,
they could still be clear, but yet not a violation of the False Claims Act.
That is correct. We believe that scienter is present, though.
And so what would the defendant have to show to demonstrate lack of scienter if the contracts are unambiguous?
What would the defendant have to show?
Yeah.
That they didn't know what was going on, that they did not believe what they were doing.
If the notes are unambiguous, right? If they're clear, as you say they are, what?
Well, the False Claims Act requires a knowing action by a defendant, and we believe that there is knowing that these actions were taken knowingly. MHFA, of course, disagrees with us.
No, my point is, let me try again.
Sure, I'm sorry.
If the contracts are clear and unambiguous, how could they not have not known? Sorry for all the negatives.
Well, I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
Well, that's why I was asking you the question, whether or not you think if they're clear, there's automatically knowledge. You said no. And in your briefs, you're arguing for, you say even if you're right that they're unambiguous in your favor, that it needs to go back for, it needs to be a trial and scienter on knowledge.
Well,
I'm not trying to push you into an argument you don't want to make.
Could it be?
Yeah, look, they're clear, but you know, you've got to really work at it to figure out that they're clear. And
the other two are a little more obscure or opaque, perhaps, is is the best way of describing it. Mm-hmm. But certainly we believe that the type 1 notes are clear on the face of it. The language is such that it requires a reduction of the interest rate if new bonds are issued to refund the current bonds backing that loan.
You think that what you just said is clear? You think that's reflected in the language here?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And if I may, language is that the rate shall be, and I'm quoting now, at a rate equal to the net interest cost which the payee is required to pay from time to time on bonds to fund or refund the loan. Now,
and you're resting on or refund, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And this is what happened here. They refunded the bond supporting the loan.
They refunded the bond, not the loan.
Well, you don't. If you look at the language for the interim loans during the construction period, and this period sometime went on for several years for a variety of reasons. The construction was finished, but the market wasn't right or something like that, so they kept rolling over their short-term loans. And that language is essentially the same. The interest rate should be, from time to time, be adjusted upward or downward based on the net interest cost paid by the payee, that would be MHFA, on notes used to fund or refund the loan. And the only difference is that
and then there's
about
a,
notes to refund
and
the
then
loan.
There's a date certain commencing on the day on which payee issues bonds. Isn't that the date certain at which the rate is fixed?
That's the date when bonds are issued, Your Honor. And that doesn't say anything about a fixed rate.
No, but it's distinct from the language that's used with respect to the BANs or bands. Not sure what you call them.
Well, sorry, but I have to read again. The interest rate from time to time be adjusted upward or downward based on the net interest cost paid by the payee on notes used to fund or refund the loan. That's for the short-term interim financing. You go drop down a little bit, and it says, after the bonds are issued, and I'm quoting the interest rate, now I'm quoting, at a rate equal to the net interest cost, which the payee is required to pay from time to time on bonds to fund or refund the loan. The only difference is the word notes is used in one of those clauses. In the other, the word bonds.
In the first one, it says interest rate shall from time to time be adjusted. In the second one, it doesn't. I don't mean that to mean your interpretation is ultimately wrong, but there's a distinction in the language there.
Well, it shall be, or adjusted, shall be indicates when you look at the required to pay from time to time. The time to time is the crucial language here. It is, and we presented evidence as to the 1972 bond resolution, which governed all of these notes from 1972 until the 1993 refunder took place. That shows that this language is specifically out of the bond resolution. Now, I don't have time to go into all of that, but that's in our briefs and at some length. My co-counsel thought it was too lengthy, but it is. But it is there, and it's directly derived from that bond resolution, which was in effect at the time that this refunder took place. Now, once the refunder took place, they defeased or paid off all the bonds, and they subjected these loans to a new bond resolution. Didn't get HUD's approval on that, but that's another story. That they should have gotten. As we point out, the interest reduction contract requires that approval of HUD is required to assign the interest of one of the parties to somebody else. In this case, they would have assigned as these notes as security for the new bond issue. We think that with respect to Sienter, that the failure to get an opinion of counsel, as they had done the year before with respect to another bond refunder of a different type of loan, set of loans, is a fatal error in this case.
They did ask in-house counsel, didn't they?
They did not. No, Your Honor. They had opinion of counsel with respect to the 1992 policy.
I thought they asked in-house counsel whether or not.
And then when asked after the fact, they cited the 1992 opinion as the basis for their action on the 1993 opinion, bond refunder. And then they also cited...
Does this argument depend on whether the contract language is ambiguous or unambiguous? Suppose it's ambiguous. Do they still have to get advice of counsel? I mean, the 92 was a different program. Wasn't that 8A?
Section 8 program.
Yeah, Section 8 program. So,
and the note terms were, the terminology was not as clear-cut as it is in this case.
Right.
And their note terminology in those mm-hmm. loans is not as clear cut as we believe it is in at least the Type 1 notes.
Okay. Thank you. You're over your time.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas Bondi. I represent the United States as amicus in this case. Mm-hmm. Just like to reiterate briefly, Your Honors, as we stated in our brief, we take no position in this case on the ultimate outcome of the litigation or the ultimate outcome of this appeal. Our amicus participation in this case is limited to discussing two general False Claims Act issues, which, although not necessarily presented directly front and center, in this case are sufficiently important and we think sufficiently present in the case that we thought respectfully it would be helpful for the court to make a short amicus filing. The two issues that we've spoken on in our briefs are the so-called reasonable interpretation point and the government knowledge point. And on both of those issues, really our position is that on neither of those things, that the False Claims Act defendant claims to have a reasonable interpretation of the underlying provision, or that the government has knowledge of some or all of the potentially false facts, neither of those is any kind of automatic legal defense under the False Claims Act, although depending on the facts and circumstances, both could go to scienter.
So is it the government's view that the fact that HUD continued, has always made these payments, is that irrelevant?
I'm not sure I'd say it's irrelevant. I guess the point I'd really like to make is that it's difficult, as a general matter, to know what inference to draw from the fact that the government continues to make payments.
Well, don't you think it's making these million-dollar payments. Don't you think that suggests that HUD thinks they're lawful?
Not necessarily. And if
really?
If I can give you...
That's really kind of frightening about the government.
Let me give you a couple of illustrations, because I think there is a real point here. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not saying what inference should or should not be drawn under the facts of this case.
We understand.
Address that, but
we understand.
Let me just give you, if I may, Your Honor, just a couple of hypotheticals to flesh this out. Imagine if a contractor contracts to build a building for the government, and as a material part of the whole transaction, promises as part of the contract that at every stage specified portions of the subcontracting work will be undertaken by minority firms. And let's assume that isn't done. It's just outright fraud. It's a total lie. And about halfway through, the government happens to discover it, and the building's halfway built. And the building's a fine building. It's a perfectly fine building. The government gets value from it. The government can decide at this point, even though it thinks there has been potential fraud, to just keep making the payments and
okay,
get the building.
So
that's the most effective
solution.
Okay, so
I understand you don't want to take a position in this case, but that's not even close to the facts of this case. What you're saying is that I understand that in some circumstances the continued payments may not be relevant, but that doesn't mean they're irrelevant in all cases.
I'm not saying they're irrelevant in all cases, Your Honor, but if I may, let me give you another different kind of hypothetical just to flesh
out. You don't
want
to use this case as a hypothetical, huh?
Well, but
I can't get you to do that.
Your Honor, the payments can be made not only intentionally for good reason, even though the government might be aware that there is some fraud. It can also be done, if you will, sort of inadvertently, if the person on the government side...
Let me go back to your other case, by the way. Just let's take your hypothetical about the minority contractor. Wouldn't the government, in that circumstances, if it thought the building was reasonable, c- continue to make the payments but take some action against the contractor for not fulfilling his terms of the agreement?
I don't know. Not necessarily.
Well,
but what
I can't imagine why they wouldn't.
Well, but if they wouldn't, all I'm saying is if you look at the contractor, if the contractor has made false claims and they are knowingly false, that meets the falsity and scienter elements of the statute, and what the government does is sort of beside the point.
But here it goes right to the amount of money the government's paying. So you're suggesting that the government's just spending large amounts of money for no apparent reason.
No, and again, we're just making the general point that it can be difficult to infer from how the government reacts to what the contractor does. That can
You concede that you could make the inference.
Yes.
So then I'm not sure what you're contributing to this case, other than to say that it's not automatic. Is that your point?
Yes.
In other words?
That is our point.
That's your only point.
It's not automatic.
Okay.
Well, on your other point, that reasonable interpretation of ambiguous language is not a defense, why not? How can it be reckless if it's, or knowledgeable if it's a reasonable interpretation?
Well, I guess let me make clear what we mean by reasonable. What we mean by reasonable in that sense, and I think the way the courts have talked about it, I guess the shorthand I'd use is reasonable in a Chevron kind of sense. So let's suppose a contractor certifies compliance with a statute.
Mm-hmm.
And in a Chevron kind of sense, a statute can have multiple reasonable interpretations in that sense. But it's possible that...
So not taking a different interpretation is reckless?
Yes, if, for example, it can be more than reckless. It can be actual knowledge. For example, consider a situation in which the agency, say in a formal regulation or policy directives or what have you, has itself adopted one of those reasonable interpretations, and that becomes legally the authoritative meaning of the statute. If you're a contractor, you can't just secretly depart from that.
Yeah, but here there's no other fixed meaning that's been declared the meaning. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, but I'm just saying in general there are any number of circumstances where just because you have an in quotes reasonable interpretation, that doesn't necessarily negate both falsity or scienter. You could have...
You are not arguing that where there has been no authoritative interpretation by the government, that a reasonable interpretation satisfies the statute.
No, at that point, Your Honor, the reasonableness of the interpretation very well could go to the state of mind and to scienter, absolutely. But again, it's on both of these points. We're just saying it's just not an automatic legal defense.
But to go back to your first point so that I can, I don't want to misunderstand the government's position, but with respect to HUD's continuing payments of interest under these agreements, the government's position is that that fact could be relevant, right?
Yes, we think the relevance just depends on the facts and circumstances of every case, but you can't necessarily infer anything one way or another just from the mere abstract fact that payments continue to be made.
But depending on the facts of the case, we might do that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Michael Tutor for the Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency. Let me just quickly address one point, just so that it's clear on the record, that HUD has, in fact, in other circumstances, and it is in the record from the RUP affidavit, has, in fact, taken set-asides, has, in fact, withheld money on other programs with Mass Housing Finance Agency during this relevant period. It has not done so at all or taken any steps with respect to this particular program. Your Honors, there are three reasons why the district court's decision here should be sustained. The first, the mortgage notes on which HUD's subsidies are based, we believe unambiguously support Mass Housing's interpretation.
Well, what does the language or refund the loan mean?
I'm sorry, refund the loan.
Or refund the loan.
Refunding the loan, as is indicated again in the record, undisputed by Mr. Burbine, the financial director, means to actually re-amortize the loan, to actually take out the loan and replace it with funds. That does occur during temporary financing, and I know money is fungible, but as a practical matter, the way that the agency...
Wait, explain that once again.
Sure.
What's the difference between that and refunding the bonds? Isn't refunding the bonds the same as refunding the loan?
No, Your Honor. Let me use a practical example. Yeah. If the bank has, if you have your home mortgage, you get funds for your 30-year mortgage, and that's typically the bank has gotten financing, capital financing, some other way. Those two things are separate. If you choose, because interest rates have gone down, to refinance your loan, you are refinancing your loan. Whether the bank has been able to find sources of funding for its capital projects separate and apart from what you're doing with your loan, those two financial transactions are entirely separate. And that's what refunding the loan means here. And to use another example from personal or the private world, when a building goes up, the project finance takes out construction loans. And those are interest only, just as these are. But when the construction loan is substantially, the construction is substantially completed, which is the very language of this, then that construction loan is taken out and it is replaced by permanent financing, which is the language you find in the interest reduction contract. At that point, the loan is refinanced or refunded.
Hold on. The language says, which the payee is required to pay from time to time, on bonds.
Correct. To fund or refund the loan.
So it's interest on the bonds.
Correct.
Right.
But that happens at one point in time, as is indicated in the interest reduction contract and is indicated here and in Judge Lamberth's opinion. First, you've got construction financing, interest only, not amortized, not subsidized.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Which the payee.
That's right.
The payee.
So that's MHFA.
Pay from time to time.
On bonds.
Yeah, on the bonds. That doesn't refer to re-amortizing the loan independently from the bonds.
No, that's the fund or refund the loan evidenced by this note. And if you go up further.
Wait.
I'm sorry.
I'm looking, for example, if you go to the record at Joint Appendix 387, which is the United Fund Homes Category 1 loan. I think you need to take the whole thing in context, if I may suggest that, Your Honor, because the paragraph begins talking about the bands. And the interest rate is set as the bands are from time to time being adjusted, upward or downward.
That's during the construction phase.
That's during the construction period.
Okay, I got that.
And then, and provided the interest shall be further adjusted, upward or downward, as the case may be, so that commencing on the date, so on that date, and if you look back at the interest reduction contract, there's a tie-in between these two. It's a specific date on which permanent financing comes into place. At that moment, there will be a further adjustment to set the interest at a rate equal to the net interest cost which the payee, Mass Housing, is required to pay from time to time on bonds to fund or refund the loan. That happens at permanent financing.
Right, but you would be completely right if the phrase or refund weren't there.
I'm sorry?
You would be completely right if the phrase or refund weren't there.
Well, I think we're...
Then it would be. Then I would understand your point.
Well, except that what's happening is the loan does already exist, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It existed as a result of the construction financing. But the loan is then taken out and refunded. It becomes a different loan because it becomes an amortized loan, it becomes a permanent loan, it becomes a 40-year loan. So the bonds do, in fact, refund the loan, but they only do it once. They do it at the time of permanent financing. Thereafter, they never refund the loan. And the loan never gets refunded. The fact that MHFA then goes and gets different financing for its own purposes, at some for capital projects, for whatever, just like your bank does, doesn't have any effect on this language. Furthermore, as Judge Lamberth wrote in his opinion, the distinction and the important, maybe subtle, distinction that appears in these loans is that the bands are, in fact, adjusted upward or downward from time to time. The bonds are not. They are further adjusted on the day that permanent financing comes into place. That's a one-time event. But if there's any confusion about this, Your Honor, I think you take a look at the program as a whole and you see the development of these notes. The interest rates that were set under these loans then are reflected in subsequent loans, which I think even my brother concedes, are clearer and clearer and clearer.
Wait, before you get to those.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can we stick with these loans? Does HUD approve these notes?
It's not in the record whether HUD approves them. I think it's safe to say, as my brother indicated, at the beginning of this program, HUD was involved in approving the notes. Thereafter,
Why would
HUD approve it?
Yeah. Why would HUD possibly have approved this arrangement?
Well, because, Your Honor, there's nothing untoward about this arrangement at all. A fixed commercial loan is established for 40 years, just like a 30-year mortgage is
fixed.
But
HUD's funding most of the loan interest payments, right?
HUD is funding.
Wouldn't HUD want to get the benefit of any future interest reductions?
Your Honor, the statutory program shows that HUD knew how to do that and did that in subsequent programs, including the Section 8 program.
But just explain to me, why would HUD want an arrangement like this?
Well,
just give me a reasonable basis for thinking HUD would want this.
Well, because no different, Your Honor, than your bank does not say to you that when interest rates go up or down, you have to come up with additional money. You get to have a fixed rate mortgage, even though they have a variable rate mortgage. You can, Your Honor.
But isn't the point also here that HUD knows that if the state can negotiate a better rate on the bonds, that the state agency in question has more money for the desired purpose of affordable housing for the citizens of the state?
That you're absolutely right, Your Honor. I mean, this is an agency that, to the extent it has additional funds, plows it back into affordable housing, financing affordable housing. These subsidies are not for the benefit of mass housing. They actually allow rents to be reduced, allow developers to build affordable housing projects. There's no suggestion of personal inurement. There's no suggestion of anything untoward except for these kind of...
Well, that may go to the scienter issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, there's no reason why...
We have to interpret the contract here.
Well, and the other reason, Your Honor, is that, as you indicated, I think, earlier in the discussion with opposing counsel, if HUD got the benefit of all of the savings from a bond refunder, there would be absolutely no commercial reason ever to take the refunder. If bond rates go down, it costs a fortune to do one of these refunders. Mm-hmm. And as we indicate and is evident in the record...
Can you give us some estimate?
Millions. Million. I mean, when you have Goldman Sachs and you have Wall Street lawyers and you have AMBAC and you have all of these professionals who, by the way, these are public bond filings. They're in the record. There's an official statement. This is widely known. All of those...
Those millions are being paid by the...
Those millions are being paid by mass housing.
Right.
Right. Okay. So for mass housing to enter into a refunder which would save it money, only to have to turn the money back to HUD would, of course, make no sense. Furthermore, none, as Judge Lamberth, I think, somewhat colorfully indicates.
So then how do you explain the Type 3 notes?
I'm sorry, Ron. Why do they become fixed?
Yeah.
For the same reason these are fixed. The Type 3 notes fix the interest rates.
I see.
With the developers. And in fact, Your Honor, I mean, I think you can see, we've cited to the United Front Homes trilogy. If you look at Joint Appendix 387 to 402, you see the development of these notes. And more to the point, mm-hmm. you see that this language that we've pointed to was then used to set an interest rate which is fixed, explicit, uh-huh. with...
Let me ask you about two other sentences.
Certainly, Your Honor.
In this massive record, okay?
Yeah.
In the Type 1 notes?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a sentence which says, if the rate of interest on this note shall change from time to time as provided above.
Yes, Your Honor.
The amount of such monthly payments shall be adjusted upward or downward, as the case may be, to provide for full amortization of this note.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why doesn't that...
If one looks at that paragraph as a whole, you'll see that it relates...
Well, why don't you start with that sentence?
If I may, Your Honor, I think if you viewed it in context, you'll see that paragraph relates to situations when there are also no bonds, because the paragraph begins, if payee has not issued bonds to refinance its funding
of
the
note.
That's very
helpful. Okay, that's good. All right.
And furthermore...
That's why we have oral arguments.
I think the second reason, Your Honor, and maybe I should quit while I'm ahead, but the second reason is that if you look at the other notes, all of the notes have a catch-all provision like this, because the key point about the notes is that they secure the bonds. And the bondholders insisted that there would always be a catch-all that says, I don't care what you do with the notes, but you're absolutely going to make sure that they are sufficiently amortizing so that we get our payments. So you'll see that in every one of the notes, the Type 2 notes, the Type 3 notes, they all have this same kind of language that says, notwithstanding anything else, there will be enough money
okay.
to pay for the bonds. Mm-hmm.
Is the interest reduction contract relevant at all to this?
It's relevant only insofar as, for 2 points. The first point is that if you read the language of the interest reduction contract, this bilateral or two-tier process is so clear about having a temporary financing situation, and then I think the language in the interest reduction contract when it relates to permanent financing says, and provided finally there will be this permanent financing and there will be a permanent loan.
Okay.
So that's the first
point.
No
one disagrees about that.
But I think it's important because it does distinguish about the fact that there will be a permanent financing regime. The second one is just, it's only relevant in that it says the subsidies will be derived from the notes.
What about this sentence? I'm looking at Joint Appendix 127, paragraph 1. The interest rate payable by the mortgage or to the mortgagee upon which subsidies will be computed shall consist of the rate which the mortgagee pays from time to time on notes and bonds which it issues to fund or refund the loan.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the same point that you see in the Category 1 notes about refunding the loan. If you refund the loan and you amortize the loan, then there is a change in the interest rate, as occurs during the moment of temporary financing. At permanent financing, you take out the loan, you replace it with a fixed rate loan, just like you do with your home mortgage.
Explain to me once more.
Explain to me once more.
Under what circumstances the loan would be, in this case, not my house, but in this case, the loan would be refunded separately from refunding the bonds?
The two are two entirely separate financial transactions.
Okay, just tell me what's more.
Okay. At the time of when one goes from temporary to permanent financing.
No. I'm beyond that. I'm in 1993 now.
There are, at the time of 1993,
the loan continues. Yeah, okay, so we're in the permanent phase.
Right. The loan is going on. There's an amortization schedule. You owe $2,500,000. Somewhere way over here, there is a bond transaction. It has to do with the cost of borrowing. You're not doing anything to the loan. The loan remains just as it was. You're not taking money out.
But explain the opposite.
When that would happen?
No, when you refund the loan but not the bonds.
You refund if for some reason the developer's loan needs to be reamortized. Let's say the developer's in trouble. The developer needs another loan. Although in these instances, one of the points is that in fact the loans remained fixed and mortgage increases were put on top of them. I think that it's very important. You'll see that they never refund the loan. When they get an increase, they put it on top of it. They have a different interest rate. It's extended to the same 40-year term, but they never refund the loan. In fact, the United Front Homes example is an excellent one of that. You'll see in the last one at 398, you'll see that there have been three separate mortgage increases, but rather than refund the loan, which is what, let's say, again, I'm sorry, your private house, but if you wanted to put on an addition, you might refinance your entire loan, or you might take an equity loan. That's what happens here. They had a fixed loan. They added another fixed loan on top. They never refund the loan. What they do with the bonds in terms of refunding.
But it's conceivable that you could refund the loans if the developer's in trouble.
Theoretically, that's possible. Your Honor, may I just briefly say that this is a summary judgment case, and it's important.
That's the only part so far about this case that's clear.
Well, but I think that's very important, and if I just may have 2 seconds to say, one has to look at the statement of undisputed facts on both the question of these ambiguous, if they are ambiguous, and the scienter point. There is no counterfactual statement to the many statements that we have made proving our good faith, proving what the contracts mean if you need to look at extrinsic evidence. There is no contrary fact. And under Anderson and Celotex and Matsushita, that's also the end of the matter as far as scienter is concerned. Thank you very much.
Okay. I think counsel used up all his time. You can take 2 minutes if you like.
Thank you.
You want to respond to this last point about refund the loan?
Well, I don't understand it, Your Honor. It says you seem to have some trouble understanding it, too. It says bonds to refund the loan. It doesn't say run loan to refund the loan. If I'm refinancing my house, I'm getting a new loan. But this is, we're talking about bonds. The language used is bonds. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hit a couple other points. For some reason, MHFA thought it was appropriate to refund bonds which supported over $90 million worth of mortgages with interest rates below the 6.135% net interest cost of this 1993 bond refunder. Furthermore, the monies to pay for this bond issue didn't come out of MHFA's coffers. Part of the bond issue, $2.some million, was for the very purpose of financing the bond issuance costs. And that's a very common feature when municipal bond financing is done.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What's your point? The benefit they got, they use for low-income housing, right, in Massachusetts?
Well, again, Your Honor, I say that the end doesn't justify the means. I mean, they're saying that it's all right, we do whatever we want, as long as we use it for a good purpose. And I don't think that's a legitimate basis for our public policy to be developed, or for relationships between the federal government and state entities, or state-associated entities. Mm-hmm. With respect to the $2.2 million, they've made a big point that this is, why would they have done this if they had to pay out all this money and they didn't get any other benefit? The point I'm trying to make is that they paid out the money, they borrowed the money to pay it out, and that money was paid back by the holders, the note holders, or the borrowers, over the course of the following term of the bond issue. Mr. Burbine, I'm sorry, my time's up.
Yeah, you have any other questions? No. Okay, thank you very much. Case is submitted.